Сергей Юрьевич.
Да.
Докладываю.
В Харькове. В Харькове вошли люди, выкинули всех там. Нам очень важно, чтобы были обращения людей к Путину. Массовое
собирать этот облсовет, собирать его в кучу. Идти на решительные действия, так как сделали в Харькове и в Донецке. Там уже пришел не приголосовался.
Before the guns of April came the protests of February and March. Before the armed conflict came the unarmed uprisings. Before there was a war in the Donbass, there was the so-called Russian Spring. There's scant doubt about the Kremlin's deep involvement in and instigation of the war in Ukraine's Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts that began in April 2014. But the mass anti-government demonstrations that erupted in Russophone cities in eastern and southern Ukraine in the months prior, dubbed the Russian Spring by the pro-Kremlin media, were always much more ambiguous. In the hypercharged and chaotic environment after pro-Moscow President Viktor Yanukovych was ousted by the Euromaidan uprising in Kyiv, it was entirely plausible that the Russian Spring was an organic local grassroots phenomenon that the Kremlin merely exploited and piggybacked on. But if that was once plausible, it isn't anymore. Ukraine's Prosecutor General's office this week released what it says are transcripts of Kremlin aide Sergei Glazyev speaking to proxies about instigating unrest in eastern and southern Ukraine as early as February 2014, before Russia even annexed Crimea. The protests that preceded the war, it appears, were also completely orchestrated and financed by Moscow. So how does this change our understanding of the war in the Donbass? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a senior fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Kyiv is Andreas Umland of the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation. Welcome, Andreas.
Hello, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Vienna is Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting fellow at the Institute of Human Sciences. Welcome back, Anton.
Hello, Brian.
So let's start with you, Andreas, since it's basically your fault for we're doing this. Andreas brought the importance of this issue to everybody's attention in a much-trafficked Facebook post yesterday. It certainly got my attention. So since this is your fault we're doing this, we start with you. You argued in that post quite passionately, Andreas, that the Glazyev tapes are a sensation that should change the narrative about the origins of the war in the Donbass. Explain your case for us.
Yes, I think until recently, the sort of consensus, I would say, in both in media and in academia was that Russia was involved in triggering this pseudo-civil war in April 2014, and that the demonstrations and protests and storming of public buildings in late February and in March 2014 were basically mirroring the events during the Euromaidan in Western Ukraine and Kyiv and so on. And so that what was happening before the actual war was actually a grassroots movement in Eastern Ukraine, reflecting the alleged division of Ukraine. And to a certain degree, that is, of course, still true. There was some grassroots. There were some grassroots for this, but now I think these publications, they change the picture, and they now paint a picture that I'm now seeing the Crimea operation, things that were happening in Crimea, much more in connection with what was happening in Kharkiv, in the Donbas, in Odessa at the same time. And it looks to me now that this was all a concerted action in the whole of Novorossiya, including Crimea. And Crimea was merely the most successful part of this larger operation. The Donbas was partially successful, and Odessa and Kharkiv were obviously, and other regions were obviously unsuccessful. So to me, it does change, actually, the whole picture of the emergence of the origins of this conflict. Although I would also say that the way that the General Procuracy of Ukraine published this material was not very fortunate. It would have been better to publish the whole tapes and not make this, and maybe add then a sort of an explanation to the tapes, instead of sort of composing this video with mistakes, as Anton has already pointed out in a Facebook comment. And there is now, of course, the suspicion by many journalists, I think, in the West that these tapes are somehow tempered or manufactured or manipulated. But to me, I know Zatulin, for instance, who is on these tapes. I've met him on Ukrainian TV here. I've also studied the Glazyev a little bit. I think these are authentic tapes, actually. And therefore, their importance is out of question.
Antoine, you've commented quite a bit on this as well. We've all been kind of going back and forth of this on social media in the past few days. What's your takeaway from all this? How significant do you see this?
Well, when I first heard the tapes, I thought that they were authentic. And I think one of the arguments, I mean, why, partially the reason why I think they're authentic is that some dates do fit a general picture. And also the mistakes that the general prosecutors did when they transcribed the tapes. It also says that they did not know many phenomena that they were describing. So if they created those tapes, they would know everything, right?
Mm. So that suggests to you that they're authentic.
Yeah, they are authentic. And also,
so just a sloppy job of transcribing.
Source, exactly. And also sort of ignorance on the part of the Ukrainian security services or whatever, or general prosecutors. I don't know how do those tapes. But also, if you look at the tapes, look at the dates, and the way... So, of course, the question is, who did those tapes? It's probably Ukrainian security service.
Yeah, that's what if I would imagine.
Yes, and then, like, when they did those, and it's probably just they recorded all the communications coming in or from Ukraine. You know, this Ukraine-Russia connection. It also be that they focused directly on the line of Sergei Glazyev.
Mm-hmm.
It's also very important. Like, even Zatulin, at that time when he was recorded, he was in Sevastopol.
Yes.
So again, this is Ukraine-Russia connection.
Mm-hmm.
If you analyze the dates and the tapes more closely, you will see that it all fits. The dates fit. Like when Kirill Frolov was in southern Ukraine,
mm-hmm.
also the date fits. I mean, I don't think that the security service could have created them from scratch. What struck me most importantly is that Russia needed a local uprising. Russia needed a genuine picture of a local uprising. They may be bought. I mean, those people could be bought, or they could be ideologically mobilized. But they really, really needed that picture of indigenous, you know, anti-Maidan, anti-Ukrainian revolt. And they referred to that picture, as they did in Crimea, several times.
Yeah.
They said, look, we helped Crimea. You have to do the same. If you don't do this, we will not come. If you do this, we will come. And we have this draft law on the use of Russian troops outside Russia. And they refer to it. And this is very important because this mobilized people. And it doesn't matter whether the Kremlin lied or did not lie about this, that they would join those regions that would rebel against the Kyiv government.
Yeah, this is something I wanted to zero in on with you, Antoine, because I was writing on the blog about this today, and I kind of danced around this, but I got the impression listening to the tapes, and you seem to have gotten the impression listening to the tapes, that they did intend, plan A, plan maximum, was the annexation of Novorossiya. That now appears very crystal clear. No, was that your takeaway as well?
I would still have doubts about this. I think that the Novorossiya project was a kind of they played with the reality. Whether they could do this or whether they could not do this, I mean, let's try doing this. Okay, we were fine with Crimea. It all went very smoothly. And then they probably miscalculated the eastern Ukraine and southern mm-hmm. Ukraine, regions like Odessa.
Certainly,
but
Odessa.
Still, it was you know, they played with the reality, what we can do. And also, very important, I think, when we are talking about Glazyev, we should all remember that in, I think it was August or September 2013, when the Ukrainians still discussed the association agreement with the EU, Glazyev said, and this is reported and this is hard evidence for this. He said that if Ukraine signs the association agreement with the EU, Ukraine will cease to exist.
Mm-hmm.
It will fall apart. This is also very important to remember when we are discussing these tapes and what Glazyev was coordinating with the so-called rebels in eastern Ukraine and Odessa.
That's a good point. And I would also say it's worth recalling the leaked blueprint allegedly authored by Konstantin Manofeyev that was leaked to Nova Gazeta last year about the plan to annex large portions of eastern Ukraine. This report that came out by the Russian Institute for Strategic Research, or RISI, gave this. We actually did a podcast on this at the time, yeah, if you remember, Anton. And this all fits. This was happening at the same time that blueprint was being discussed in the Kremlin. And again, this is just another way the pieces of the puzzle really fit together. I want to bring Mark into the discussion here. Mark and I have been talking off mic. He's a bit more skeptical than the rest of us, and I wanted to kind of have him kind of bring us down to earth in here, or kind of bring some skepticism into the discussion.
Well, skeptical might say about the implications rather than the actual document. I likewise have no particular concerns about whether or not this is indeed an authentic recording. Though it has to be said, exactly as others have noted, it would be nice if one did not feel that this was in part an element of Ukraine information warfare. It would be nice if precisely we actually had the whole unredacted mm-hmm. document and so forth. But there's time enough. Anyway, so the historian in me is delighted that there's more material out here and more evidence on precisely what had been a very, very murky area. In terms of sort of what this actually tells us, I'm a little bit more sceptical. I mean, I think it is useful in that I think it nails down some points that up to now we assumed or believed was the case, and now we can be much more bullish. First is, I mean, it's worth mentioning the amateurishness of this operation, which is in no way does that detract from the actual danger it poses. But, you know, Glazyev is not a professional political operator in this way. And he's just ringing people up, basically saying, come on, get some people out on the streets and such like. It can be effective in some ways. But, you know, again, this did not strike me as a particularly sophisticated sort of approach to be using. So that's the first thing. I mean, you know, that actually sort of a lot of this is very ad hoc. Secondly, the notion that precisely there is a constant I suppose marketplace or battlefield, take your pick of ideas, that goes on within the inner Kremlin circles. And this gives us an interesting way of, we don't know if Glazyev is lying or whether he is just simply presenting what was policy on that day. But definitely he is pitching it, making it sound as if actually Moscow does indeed have a much more maximalist approach.
I have orders from the top to get people on the streets in every eastern Ukrainian city that we can.
Precisely.
He says that.
Exactly. I mean, and I'm sure they would love to, but I think it's more the precisely this implication of annexation and wider things. Again, you know, we should no more regard Glazyev being honest in this case as we would Glazyev in any other instances. But I mean, I think, again, it says something about the fact that there's not necessarily this kind of crystal clear sort of policy. And a lot
but
of it
yet,
is
if he's making
hoc.
These calls, if he's putting mm-hmm. this into action and invoking, you know, as he says from the very top, I have orders to do this, that would suggest that there has been a decision.
Oh, there's no question about that. No, but I think it's the end game. And this is always the thing. I mean, this is how Putinism works. It's all very much about what are we going to do today and tomorrow? And based on how that works out, we maybe will work out what next week, next month, next year. Is going to be the thing. Because this is interesting, because in fact, I mean, on this level, you know, again, it proved to us what seemed to be the case, that precisely they were trying a whole variety of different initiatives and thrusts into these different cities. And clearly, they thought that others would be more successful than Donetsk and Luhansk. But because there things happened to work, that became the core of the initiative. So again, it's a case of adapting to situations. And I think the final sort of key thing that really emerged is precisely the extent to which this is being done politically and militarily and economically on the cheap. Again, in no way does it detract from the risk, but we should realise just how far the Russians run on bluff and promise rather than really sort of solid resources often. they can sometimes surge resources in, as we've seen. But much of the time, it's about exploiting greed and fear and hope and dissatisfaction. Final point I would say, and this is where my kind of scepticism came in terms of, as a historian, I'm interested. As a policy analyst, I wonder what this... it gives us a little bit of extra confidence in certain things, but it doesn't really change the situation on the ground. It does not matter if 1%, 10% or 50% of the people in those crowds was genuinely supportive of the whole Novorossiya project and was angry with Kiev, or whether they were paid renter mobs or whatever. The legitimacy, or more to the point, the illegitimacy of Russia's actions is absolute. And the danger is, if we start saying, aha, this proves just how illegitimate the Russian action was, we almost imply that there is an accept that if you get enough people on the streets, it's okay to invade.
Well, yeah, I know.
So, I think this is something that we have to be absolutely clear about. We can look at this as interesting evidence for how Russia operated and maybe will operate in the future, but we can't let that in any way diffuse the basic notion of the illegitimacy of Russia's actions.
I mean, a couple things that jumped out at me in terms of the minutiae. I mean, the one place where they talked about having to spread money around was Odessa. That's not surprising at all, because Odessa ideologically was going to be the least receptive to this. So there was going to be a need for more money there. And that was the one where there was the very detailed discussions about how much money they were needing to spread around. The other thing that jumped out at me is just how little these guys understand Ukraine, which is, again, this is a theme we keep coming back to. It's remarkable every time we talk about Russia and Ukraine in this podcast, how little this Kremlin understands Ukraine. I mean, what's wrong with Zaporizhia? Why aren't there some more people on the streets in Zaporizhia? Well, if anybody that knows anything about Zaporizhia would understand why there were more people on the streets, Zaporizhia wasn't going to be ideologically could do. They did seem to know that Odessa was going to need some money. But Mark, as far as what this means now in terms of policy, I think it's important in one sense. I mean, a new round of diplomacy is about to start on the Donetsk war. Putin is going to meet Francois Hollande and Angela Merkel in on the sidelines of the G20 summit in China next month. And Putin's plan of action is actually pretty clear. He's clearly trying to cut Ukraine out of the negotiations. He's trying to create a o nas bez nas type situation where the future of Ukraine is decided without Ukraine's participation. And he's coping for some grand Yalta style solution. He's talking about the West pressuring again Ukraine into accepting Moscow's interpretation of Minsk, and having this out there now, understanding more fully how this whole thing started. Even if we already understood, now we have something more of a smoking gun, closer to a smoking gun than we've ever had before.
Did we really need it, though?
A smoking gun's always better than not having a smoking gun.
Go
ahead, yeah, Andreas, jump in.
I think we always had the smoking gun about the wars, but that started in mid-April. I think it was always clear to me that this war was not just fought with captured weapons. These weapons were obviously brought from Russia. Some were captured. But about late February and early March, I was actually unsure. And I'm now much more sure that there was this Russian mingling already. Then and many things now, I think, at least for me, are falling in. They are much clearer now. For instance, we had this strange decision by the Federation Council from 1st of March 2014 till, I think, 25th of June 2014, when Russia was allowed to employ troops in Ukraine, which it officially, to the discourse at that point, never did. At that point, Russia insisted that there were no troops on Crimea, no troops in eastern and southern Ukraine. But I think this decision by the Federation Council, which was then revoked, oddly, later on, was necessary. It was a preparation for the case that Oblast Soviets, Oblast regional councils would ask Russia for help. Then, actually, Russia would have invaded, I think, Ukraine officially, if these oblasts would have delivered these requests for help. A Ukrainian state organ turning to a Russian state organ and requesting military help. So this is something that I think to me is now clearer. Also, I think now that the People's Republics, they were actually an alternative strategy. There was no plan for that. That was plan B, so to say, that only comes into play in April when plan A in March doesn't work. So plan A in February, March only works in Crimea. And then for the other regions, then comes plan B with these, with the sort of pseudo civil war, which then works out at least partially for Donetsk and Luhansk, but not in Kharkiv, Odessa, or Zaporizhia. And finally, on this, as you mentioned, this Russian Institute for Strategic Studies, there was this leak by a former employee,
yes,
of this institute, who sort of outlined how incompetent this institute was, obviously, on Ukraine. And there's, I think, this woman, Tatiana Glushkova, yes, or Glushkova, or whatever her name was, who was not a serious academic, and they had a wrong understanding of Ukraine, and they may have misinformed people like Glazyev and Zatulin, who thought that indeed they would just, you know, mingle there a little bit, and then the Oblast Soviets would come out with requests to Russia for military help. So now I see, at least for me, it looks now that the Crimea operation is actually very much part of a larger operation, which did not simply in southern and eastern Ukraine did not work. And that's why we have then this these different periods. We have Crimea, then we have the People's Republics and the civil war, the so-called civil war. In fact, it all started as one operation. And then because this operation did not work out in mainland Ukraine, then the civil war, this pseudo-civil war scenario comes in as plan B.
And I think they were keeping plan A active, at least until, like Andreas, as you said, when the Federation Council revoked that right to send troops to, yeah, Ukraine in June. But remember, they were trying stuff all the way up to there. We had the trade union incident in Odessa. They were still attempting. But Anton, you wanted to jump in. I saw.
Yeah, I wanted to stress, I think, a very important point, that this civil war narrative is extremely widespread in the academic writings. And this is important because academic writings, they can sort of try to reconstruct reality, and they will have influence on how these developments and how this war is understood in the future. And the question about whether we need that smoking gun or not, I think we do need that, because again, this narrative in academic writings, in some journalistic writings, is very much widespread. And these tapes, they do change something. And I think this change is very important.
No, and I think we're all in agreement that in the academic sense, in the sense of the narrative of history, this is very important. But what about what Mark was raising? Because the issue of how this affects policy on the ground now. Now, I would argue, and I have argued, that it could affect policy on the ground now, because when Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande and Barack Obama, for that matter, formulate their policy toward this conflict at a time when Russia is trying really hard to change Western policy on this and is getting some takers in Europe, if not in the United States, doesn't something like this come into play, Mark? I mean, wouldn't you argue?
I would say that the reason why there is some traction is not because Chancellor Merkel and others are convinced that, in fact, gosh, come to think of it, there's a lot of people in the Donbass who want to be part of a separate state or whatever. Obviously, there are some.
Some, but not a critical mass.
Exactly. I mean, I think the only reason is that there is a perspective within certain circles, especially in Europe, that some kind of peace is better than the current war. And that if you actually have to hold your nose and make a deal with Putin to get some kind of peace,
and sacrifice Ukraine's sovereignty in the process.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is part of the perspective. Because let's be honest, all sovereignty is negotiable. I mean, we'd like to think that it's actually an absolute, but in fact, all sovereignty, to an extent, in practical terms, is negotiable. And what they want to say is, actually, the best way of getting Ukraine to its maximum level of sovereignty is to basically reach some kind of a deal. Now, I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying, but I think that's
the thinking in some European
capitals.
That is
the thinking for reaching some kind of a deal, not because they've been convinced by propaganda, let alone, and I'd love to think that it's because of academic writing had any real impact. Now, I mean, joking apart, obviously, everything that affects a narrative does have some kind of cumulative impact. But, I mean, certainly in my conversations with people in Brussels and elsewhere, it's a much more realpolitik perspective than anything else. It's that basically, like it or not, given that it's not as though Europe is going to bring some kind of Marshall Plan for Ukraine or anything like that, within the sort of the policy constraints, there are those who say that the best thing to do is to reach some kind of deal with Putin. It will be a shabby compromise, but that's where it comes from.
Mm-hmm. Anton, Andreas, what are your thoughts on this? Because this is actually what it comes down. I mean, if you're taking this out of the academic context, and I would not demean the importance of that. It is very important. But in terms of policy right now, what do you think is the, can this, when Chancellor Merkel looks at this, or at least gets a readout of these tapes or however they're going to be presented to her, is this going to affect how Germany approaches this when Chancellor Merkel meets with Putin in China next month, or French President Hollande, for that matter? What do you think the impact in terms of policy is going to be here, if any? Andreas, what are...
Well, I think that's difficult to predict, but I think that is going... I would think it should have some repercussions. For instance, I mean, the odd thing about the Minsk agreements is they've been adopted after the sanctions were introduced. And the sanctions were solely introduced because of the Russian invasion of eastern Ukraine. But then the sanctions are now, the lifting of the sanctions is now tied to Ukraine also fulfilling certain conditions, what has been agreed in the Minsk agreements. For instance, giving the currently occupied territories a special status. And the sort of the thinking behind is that there was some genuine, actually, uprising in these regions, mm-hmm. which Russia then supported and weaponized and escalated and so on. But there was this uprising, and Ukraine has to react to that, and Ukraine has to deliver something to these insurgents in eastern Ukraine. But now actually the picture is changing, that this insurgency already in late February and March was to a large degree orchestrated. Certainly there was some grassroots support for that. But now this whole issue of a special status for these regions looks differently. And I think there are more and more arguments who would say, well, the sanctions were imposed before the first Minsk agreement was signed. So the sanctions should only be related to Russia's behavior and not to Ukraine's behavior, which is, I mean, this whole link between the sanctions and Ukraine, it's changing its constitution and its legislation is dubious anyway. But to me, at least, it looks now even more dubious than it used to before.
No, Andreas, I think you raise a really interesting point here, because the Minsk agreements were based on I think they're based on several fictions. The biggest fiction in the Minsk agreements is that the Russians were a mediator in a conflict, in fact, in which they were the aggressor. That's fiction number one. But you hit on fiction number two here, is that even though Moscow was the aggressor and the instigator, they were predicated on this notion that there is something about these separatist territories that warranted them having some special status. And that's predicated on that there were these uprisings before the war, and that there were sentiment in this region that has to be taken into account. These tapes undermine that entirely. And that means one of the key bases for the Minsk agreements, or at least this part of the Minsk agreements, has just been blown up. No, Anton, what do you think?
Yes, I think that these tapes they do undermine the basis or the foundation for the Minsk. But also, I'd like to remind you that these two Minsk agreements, yes, the first one and the second one, they all took place after two large invasions coming from Russia. So the first invasion in August 2014 and then in January, February 2015. Mm-hmm. And they also, they were desperate attempts, these agreements, to start, to stop the invasion, stop the full-blown invasion. So Ukraine did not really have a really good ground when they discussed with Russia and with the separatists, but of course those were discussions with the Russians. They did not have a solid ground. And Russia knows, and everybody knows, that if Ukraine does not deliver, the Russians could repeat the same mm-hmm. trick. And anyway, Minsk II does not work. It's just a useless piece of paper.
Mark, you were writing, so you must have something to say.
Well, obviously, I'm currently sort of channeling my inner cynic. I mean, when we come to Minsk...
Something new.
look, I don't think that the Western powers gave or talked about special status for the Donbass regions because they felt it was a matter of natural justice for southeast Ukrainians who were labouring under the yoke of Kiev. It's because that was just part of the deal that Russia was demanding, and they wanted to reach some kind of a deal. Admittedly, I mean, I absolutely agree, Minsk II in particular, deeply stupid, dangerous and unfortunate. But nonetheless, I think that was the calculation behind it. It wasn't based on sort of naive assumptions about what was going on there. Mm. But the second point is, again, when it comes back to it, it's, well, so what? So even if the deal was therefore based on fictions... It's like anything you buy because an advert doesn't necessarily tell you the truth. It's all very well, and morally speaking, that might well be a bad thing. But in practical terms, Putin is not going to turn around and say, it's a fair cop, Gov. You caught me out, and therefore I will back away. You know, Putin, if anything else, he has an armour-plated hide. He is perfectly willing to just simply say, no, this is nonsense. The bottom line is precisely Russia is in a position that it can and will continue to cause trouble up to and including military intervention in southeast Ukraine. The facts are entirely irrelevant to that. And again, this is not in any way trying to say all this, so none of this matters. I mean, but in a way, what this does is it demonstrates to us what we have always assumed. I mean, there has been no real question about the fact that there are Russian forces in the Donbass. So maybe, in a way, it shifts our timeline, which, again, is interesting as we understand the process. But for here and now, in policy terms, it really doesn't matter because the Russians are simply sitting there thinking, well, what kind of a deal can we make?
So there's zero policy implications of this.
Well, I mean, I won't say zero. I mean, I sort of question and push back the idea that it was really strong. I mean, obviously, anything that helps maintain the consensus within the West, particularly in Europe, where we know there are wobblier countries than others, anything like this helps. And to be honest, I presume, I don't think it's just random chance that this is when the Ukrainians chose to release it. I don't think it's that they've been going through their back order of cassettes and just suddenly came across it and thought, oh, that's handy. No, I mean, if they have any sense, precisely, at some point they came across this and they had been waiting for the right kind of moment, a point when they actually felt that Europe was looking a bit wobblier and they wanted this raise. And in this respect, I mean, to go back, I mean, I think Andros is exactly right in beating the drum about the significance of this.
Yeah, I think we all owe a debt to Andreas for raising everybody's consciousness about this.
In some ways, not so much necessarily for the detail of the tapes, but for the fact of the tapes. It's another opportunity, because otherwise what happens is precisely this is the ADD politics age. We get distracted. It's, Crimea. Oh, that was so 2014. we forget, and it gets lost in the chatter. Yeah. So anything like this is actually very useful in that respect. So of course it has a policy implication, but as I said, I think the policy implication is for the fact of the tape rather than necessarily the detail of what was actually said on the tape.
You raised Crimea, and I want to go to Anton about this as well, and I see you, Andreas, on this, but because this wasn't, these tapes weren't just about eastern Ukraine. There was also quite a bit about Crimea. Did you see anything in there about Crimea that surprised you or added to your knowledge of what happened in Crimea, or was that just, again, confirming what we already knew?
Yes, it was quite interesting for me to hear one name of a guy that I heard about him several years ago, Konstantin Khmelnik, who is erroneously called Khmerik in the tapes, but this is one of the cases when the general prosecutors of Ukraine, they simply did not know some of the realities in Ukraine. So that guy, I remember in 2007, he was the leader of the Crimean branch of the Eurasian Youth Union, which was founded in 2005 by the followers of Russian fascist Alexander Dugin. And he was working and he was undermining or trying to undermine Ukraine's sovereignty and especially in Crimea, although he did not have all those resources. But since 2007, and he was, the security services of Ukraine were interested in him, and they even tried to sort of open a criminal case against him, but he survived. And then in 2014 with the Crimea, and I hear Glazyev saying to Sergei Aksyonov, the so-called head of the Crimean administration, just don't forget about that guy of ours. Like, give him something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
This is very interesting because there is also this link between Glazyev and Alexander Dugin. Because I remember Alexander Dugin on Facebook in March and April 2014, again, writing about all those supporters that the Russians had in Crimea several years ago, saying, just let's not forget those guys who were with us several years ago already. Let's give them something. Mm. But interestingly, that did not happen to Khmerik. He was not given any position in the administration. He was given, in the end, he became the head of one media website, like media agency, but not anything close to executive.
Right. So the people that were helping out towards this cause were kind of tossed aside.
Ten years ago, they tried to do that, and they were given nothing this time.
Uh-huh. Andreas, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I maybe wanted to connect a little bit what Anton said before with the background of the Minsk agreements, that there was the Ilovaisk battle before the first Minsk agreement, and then the Debaltseve battle simultaneously with the second Minsk agreement. And certainly this Ukrainian, specifically Ukrainian background was the reason that Poroshenko signed both of these agreements. But now it has turned out that the particular texts of these agreements, which were agreed under enormous pressure on Ukraine when these bloody battles were taking place or just had taken place, they are now part of the sanctions discussion in the West, in Germany, for instance. So, and that's why these tapes are important, because the whole discussion in Germany is now about the issue that, well, Ukraine is not fulfilling its part of the Minsk agreements. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not, it has not changed its constitution. It has not conducted elections. It has not done all the necessary changes in its legislation. And then this is again then linked with this idea that indeed, I mean, there is actually Russia has a case to demand these special rights for these currently occupied territories, and you know, you have to go in the direction of Russia. You have to come to an agreement. But I think these tapes now change the picture, because this whole sort of narrative of these aggrieved territories is now much weaker than it used to be. I think it's still there. I think there's a case to be made for special grievances in these regions, which have to be addressed by Kiev, but now this the picture looks different. And I was also, that's why I mentioned that on Facebook and made a fuss about it, is that what we have here is a tip of an iceberg. And what some of the journalists, the first who commented at all on this, they were discussing about the iceberg and whether this tip of the iceberg is, you know, whether why not the whole tape was, not all of the tapes were published, whether these tapes can be believed to be true. And allegedly Glazyev says, and reportedly Zatulin says, and so on. But what should interest us is actually not the tip of the iceberg, but the larger part of the iceberg under the surface. Because, I mean, what we now know is just a little part of the story. And the suspicion is, of course, that there's a much larger story, that there are much more conversations, much more communication, and much more money flowing. Because, you know, this is just a few conversations we heard. And the suspicion is, of course, that there were many more conversations, many more interactions, which we don't know about. And this is what the journalists and the researchers should worry about and not discuss whether these tapes are fake or not. I think they are not fake, and the research should go in a completely different direction.
No, and I think, as Antoine pointed out very early in the game, that if you look at the dates, it's pretty clear that everything kind of fits together. And call me crazy, Andreas, but I would not be surprised if we see a few more of these things popping up from the Ukrainian prosecutors in the coming weeks. On that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at Ukraine's new-look military and Russia's military buildup on Ukraine's borders. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Kyiv is Andreas Umland of the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation. And joining us via Skype from Vienna is Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Украина отмечает День независимости.
В Киеве сегодня проходят торжественные мероприятия по случаю 25-летия
боевой техники и 3000 военнослужащих.
Президентская речь продлилась около получаса.
Ukraine marked a milestone this week, 25 years of independence, but they celebrated it under the barrel of a gun with a massive Russian troop buildup on its borders, an escalating war in the Donbass, and Russian saber rattling in Crimea. But the authorities in Kyiv also put on a show of strength themselves with a military parade designed to show off Ukraine's new-look army. Mark, what do you think the Russians have up their sleeves with this buildup? And is Ukraine's spiffy new military with their nice new uniforms ready to stand up to it?
Well, fortunately, I don't actually think necessarily it's a question of a direct clash at this stage. I mean, we see a Russian buildup. In part, the Russian build-up actually can be explained by regular troop rotations, but there is also clearly an actual build-up. And very much I follow the line that Michael Kaufman in DC has pushed, that this is not actually that the Russians are arming for invasion. It's rather what they are concerned about is precisely this spiffy Ukrainian military that's still in the building. And what they're worried about is a sort of Croatian scenario, in which over the time the Ukrainians are able to build up the force that they can militarily take back the Donbass, and they want to have the forces there to deter or need be to resist. Because I do think that actually, if one looks at the Ukrainian military, it is something of a success story, very much a work in progress, and clearly it's very difficult for Ukraine given its current economic and political circumstances. They're spending over 2.5% of their GDP on the military, and although a lot of the reports are focused on things like the very new, very Western-style uniforms that their senior officers have had, if one looks at the nuts and bolts, they've got about 250,000 men and women in their armed forces. About 40-something thousand of those are civilians. They've got around 50,000 troops deployed around the anti-terrorist operation zone, in other words, around the Donbass. They could probably surge another 50,000, if need be, without the full mobilization and martial law that Poroshenko sort of threatened and warns every now and then. Perhaps most interestingly, 75% of the military is now professional, because they sort of went professional for a while and they brought back conscription because they basically needed warm bodies. But they're actually sort of pushing back. So, you know, so they have a substantial force. It still clearly has some sort of, you know, flaws, but then again, so too do the Russians. But the thing is that this is now no longer the situation of 2014, when the Russians really were in a position to launch a kind of shock and awe offensive if they had really wanted to. They still, obviously the Russians still have a superiority in air power and a theatre superiority in artillery. But if you're going to invade and certainly hold and pacify areas, you need to have quite a substantial strength. And if one looks at what's happening in the Donbass, when the Russians have deployed, and they've been very successful, but they've been very successful in part because they've deployed their best units. The reason why they have these composite battalion tactical groups there is because they literally have to strip out the all professional elements of existing brigades and so forth and bolt them together because they can't send conscripts for reasons legal, political, but also just practical. Mm-hmm. And secondly, they use massive firepower. Now, okay, they're trying to use drones now much more, sort of try and sort of not have to use the same sort of massive firepower they have in the past. But that's what they really do. They focus a lot of firepower. Now, that's been successful, but there's the reason why the Russian deployments have always been short, sharp shocks. Not just because that's sort of all it's needed, but also because they literally run out of ammunition. They get through more than their mm-hmm. logistical train can actually provide them. And that's in relatively small-scale, relatively focused deployments. If we're talking about a full-scale war, we're talking about something that is much bigger, and actually would basically bring to light this perennial Russian problem that they focus on the teeth, on the fighting arms, and neglect the tail, the logistics. And you know, any general knows logistics is what actually wins wars. So I think we've got a situation in which actually the Russians, yes, they may have around 80,000 troops in and close to theatre now. They're not in a position to do some kind of massive surge. They no longer have the clear superiority in organisation and discipline that once they had. The Ukrainians are actually building the core of really quite a successful force. And last point I'd make is talking to some of the, particularly American, but generally sort of Western officers who have been embedded with or been involved in training the Ukrainians. The interesting thing they come back is, yes, there's a lot of training assistance they can provide. But they're also learning a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Ukrainians are basically the only people who can now say that they have experience in fighting tank battles with Russians, modern right. Russians, and so forth. They're very much sort of facing the new Russian use of drones. You know, there's actually a lot that they are able to actually impart to NATO rather than it all being the other way around. And because it's a professional military, a fair amount of that organizational knowledge is retained.
Yeah.
So we certainly shouldn't rule out the Ukrainian military.
No, that's a comprehensive synopsis, Aaron. Actually, and you referenced Michael Kaufman's excellent blog post this week, where he makes the point that Russia is specifically trying to avoid the so-called Croatian scenario, where we're referring to the war in Croatia, where Croatia was able to take back Srpska Krajina, and Serbia wasn't able to do anything about it, despite having a superior military. And that's what this is more about. It's more about Russia deterring Ukraine, which is actually an interesting way to look at it. Anton, what do you see here with both the strength of the Ukrainian military, the new look military, and what is Russia up to on the border? What do you think?
I think it's, you know, Russia is sometimes very... it's using some symbolic narratives. Like everybody knows, I think, in the academic circles and in journalistic circles and expert circles about August, you know, the Black August, mm-hmm. Related to Russia. And then you see that this military buildup is going on close to August. And then this Crimea operation, this mm-hmm. PSYOP, that the Russians did with the so-called Ukrainian terrorists. And then in the 19th, or was it the 18th of August, Putin is going to Crimea, like Gorbachev did
right.
in 1991. He's playing with the symbols, you know, trying to get us worried, actually. Of course, you know, the military buildup costs a lot, and this is not just for a joke. But You see all those symbolic actions and symbolic operations. If you remember when these Turkish forces brought down the Russian jet and two pilots were killed, and there was this huge wave of anti-Turkish narratives and there were sanctions against Turkey. Two Russians died. And then they saw that in Crimea, they lost two officers of the security services, and then nothing. Mm-hmm. It's just, okay, we present this case to the international community, and I'm sure that was a failure. And for Russia, this Crimea PSYOP was a failure because nobody believed them. And also nobody actually wanted to talk about this case as a terrorist attack on the Russian territory, because Crimea is not a Russian territory. So this was a failure. I don't know whether whether the Russians are going to take it any further with this psyop that they did in Crimea, but it does give you a sense that Russia is trying to frighten. And I think that's an interesting perspective to look at Russia as deterring Ukraine, just not to go back to this full-blown invasion, or almost open invasion. It's trying with this. It's still the hybrid. It's still mostly a psychological operations against Ukraine and against the international community.
Yeah, no, I think much of this is aimed at the G20 and Putin's meetings with Merkel and Hollande. But Mark has a good point that the Ukrainian army has kind of gotten its act together, and maybe they're getting a little bit nervous about the so-called Croatia scenario, no?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a military expert, so I would presume that Russia is still trying to minimize the costs of its war against Russia, against Ukraine. Sorry.
Okay, we have a few minutes left. Go to Andreas for the last word. Since it's his fault we're doing this.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the logic of this argument that Russia is deterring Ukraine would then be, in no case should we give Ukraine modern weapons, because then Russia would be even more scared, if we give anti-aircraft weapons or anti-tank weapons. I think this logic is a bit misleading. I'm not, I'm also not a military expert, but I would still suppose that even in terms of conventional arms, not to speak of nuclear weapons, the Russian force would be so much stronger than the Ukrainian force that there would have to be a lot of buildup on the Ukrainian side to really pose a threat. And also, I mean, the recapturing of the occupied territories in Luhansk and in Donetsk, I mean, that would be a pretext for an official Russian participation in the war if Ukraine would really start an offensive there. That would mean that Russia would employ aircraft, that Russia would send really heavy weapons. I think this whole idea that that maybe it's better that Ukraine is not too strong, because otherwise they would actually attack Russia, or at least the so-called People's Republics, is a bit strange to me. For me, the most important here is as it has always been with Putin. It's not Putin's relationship to Ukraine or Putin's relationship to the West, or whether Russia gets some territory for Ukraine or not. The most important relationship is between Putin and the population and the elite of Russia, and these military buildups, they could in a certain scenario be a preparation for a military invasion. The purpose of such a new offensive would not be to gain new territory perhaps, but to destabilize Ukraine, because more destabilization of Ukraine would be good for Putin's standing in Russia. He could present that as a success, and I would even say that the current buildup of weapons and the whole feeling of insecurity in eastern and southern Ukraine is beneficial to the Russian regime, because it creates insecurity in Ukraine, it scares away investors, it weakens Ukraine as an economic actor, it drives people to emigrate. It creates all sorts of uncertainties that weaken the Ukrainian state, and that weakness of the Ukrainian state is good for the current Russian regime, because it illustrates to the Russian population how bad democratization and Europeanization is. Mm-hmm. That is the whole narrative, and that's why Russia should not democratize and Europeanize. So I think to look at it in these sort of classical military terms, how much territory could Russia occupy? How could they hold the territory? What would be the sort of the long-term implications? That's not how these people think. I think they, for them, it's not so important to have Donbass or not to have Donbass. For them, it's important to keep their villas and their yachts and their privileges and their power. That's what it's all about, and not some territory in Ukraine or elsewhere.
Right, and I lied because that wasn't the last word, because Mark wants to jump in, but that truly has to be the last word because we're really bumping up against
just
it.
Just really briefly, I mean, I don't think anyone for a moment is either thinking that Ukraine is in a position imminently to move against Donbass and Luhansk. I mean, this is long term. Secondly, that is in no way, therefore, a reason to not arm Ukraine. I mean, I'm actually really quite surprised that Andreas seemed to think that there was some kind of connection. Quite the opposite, actually. It's exactly because of the existing support that, Ukraine is now in a position to defend itself more effectively, and the Russians are getting concerned about that. I see no reason to stop, and exactly, I think, you know, things like anti-air capabilities would be the advantage. And finally, look, if Russia launched some kind of major operation, it might well destabilise Ukraine. Goodbye, though, any chance of getting sanctions lifted, and hello to a whole bunch of new sanctions. Then, if they do that, then they're basically completely shifting the basis on which they're going to have to try and relate to the West.
Yeah, and I wouldn't expect them to do anything until we see what happens at the G20 next month, when Putin meets with Hollande and Merkel without Poroshenko, which is what he wanted and what he got. Well, on that note, we'll wrap it up, since that's all the time we have today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Czech Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Kyiv has been Andreas Umland of the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation in Kyiv. And also joining us via Skype from Vienna has been Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. Thank you, gentlemen, for an exciting and interesting and enlightening discussion.
It's been fun.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog, and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.